You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, March 6, 2026. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. According to a December 2025 report from the Centre for Future Work, fossil fuel jobs in Canada are in decline and will likely continue to drop in the years to come. Not just because of climate policy, but because of technology, economic changes, resource limits, and corporate greed. As director of the Centre for Future Work, Jim Stanford, explains, many fossil fuel workers are close to retirement, and surveys show they're most interested in early retirement options and transition plans supported by unions. The issue of fossil fuel jobs in decline isn't about whether or not they will continue to decline, they will, but about how to manage the transition fairly for workers. This week on Rabble Radio, Rabble labor reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga is joined by Jim Stanford. Take a listen.
Hey Jim, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Gabby. I love Rabble, and thank you for having me.
Yeah, and just to get started, you know, today we're going to be talking a bit about, you know, the just transition and things like that. And a report recently came out last year. For our listeners who are maybe not familiar with that report, could you tell us a bit about it?
Sure. We had a report from our Center for Future Work that looked at how employment is transitioning and how it is going to keep transitioning away from fossil fuel industries towards other sectors of the economy. How fast is it happening? What happens to the workers who shift out of fossil fuels? And what are the ways to kind of smooth that transition so it's more gradual, less disruptive, and fairer? So I would say that one of the key points of the report is that the transition is happening, and not so much because of climate policy. This is, in a way, kind of interesting. We've seen a very significant decline, almost 20% decline in the number of people working in fossil fuel industries in Canada over the last decade, even though the total amount of oil and gas produced in Canada has grown a lot. So what's happening is the petroleum industry is producing more, and that's in a way bad for the environment, but they're doing it with fewer workers. They've found ways, you know, through automation or cost cutting or outsourcing to do that business with less human input. And so as a result, you've seen a significant decline in fossil fuel employment, about 40,000 jobs lost. And I think this is surprising for people, you know, because they think transition means, you know, some kind of well-meaning environmental policy. But that's not how it's happening. It's called corporate greed and the search for increased profits that's driving this transition. And unfortunately, for those 40,000 people, there was no support. There was no plan. There was no, you know, help to find new skills or new jobs or relocate. They were just thrown out. So in a way, this is an example of how not to do a transition. And it's important for people to understand that this is happening. And it's not happening because of, you know, well-meaning climate policy. It's happening because of the actions of corporations.
Yeah, and you've mentioned something interesting there. This is kind of how not to do a transition. So what would it be that you would kind of rather see? You know, we're seeing these 40,000 jobs lost. How should this have been done instead?
Yeah, and interestingly enough, Canada's got a lot of experience with how not to do transitions, because we've always had a resource-based economy with booms and busts all over the place. So we've seen other examples of this, the collapse of the cod fishery in Newfoundland in the 1990s. The ongoing series of crises in the forestry sector in Western Canada, even in industry, think about the downturn in manufacturing that happened in Canada, you know, central Canada in particular, but it was felt across the country in the first decade of the 2000s. We lost hundreds of thousands of jobs from manufacturing. So there's nothing new about people having to change their industries. And in this regard, I think the weaponization of fears about job loss in the fossil fuel industry by the petroleum sector, which is using these fears to try and justify, you know, government support for increased fossil fuel production, is quite artificial. I mean, Canada's always had a boom and bust economy, so there's nothing new about this. And in general, unfortunately, we just throw people out on the street. So the other thing that our report emphasized was that if we plan this, if we think ahead, if we do it gradually rather than suddenly, and if we provide workers and communities with options for how they can adjust to the eventual phase out of fossil fuels, which we know is going to happen, then we can do this without throwing large numbers of people out on the street. The interesting thing, Gabby, is if we plan this, you know, we're supposed to get to a net zero economy by 2050. That's the goal that the government has accepted, and most countries around the world have also accepted. Then we've got some good time to plan. We've got a quarter century to plan this. And if you do it gradually over a quarter century, then you can absorb most of the transition through retirements. Most fossil fuel workers are going to retire in the next quarter century. In fact, fossil fuel workers on average are older than the average for the Canadian workforce. So planning in advance, encouraging people to retire, giving them support to retire early is a big part of a successful plan. Then on top of that, you can have other measures. If somebody's too young to retire but wants to or needs to move to another industry, then obviously you can give them support for some retraining. You can pay them while they're getting retrained. You can give them support for relocation. You can look at labor market planning measures that match workers with other jobs where their skills are quite relevant. And there's all kinds of potential for that for fossil fuel workers. Fossil fuel workers have got skills that are quite transferable in most cases to other industries. Think about well drillers, for example, and pipe fitters and all the things involved in drilling wells, exact same skills used in geothermal. So there you go. Or think about all the engineers and technicians and computer technical staff who work in head offices for oil companies, skills immediately transferable to other other industries. And those people, by and large, live in cities. So in that regard, the transition process will be a lot easier than if you live in a small one-industry town. So the report goes through all the different dimensions that can be part of a sort of comprehensive planned transition strategy. And compared to other transitions in Canada's history, this one's relatively small, and we know that it's going to happen. It's not like the cod fishery that's collapsed all of a sudden. And if we get our act together and start working on this and planning it and doing it gradually, we can absolutely do it. I say we could do it without a single involuntary layoff in the whole industry if we did it right. And compare that to what's happening right now, where 40,000 fossil fuel workers got thrown out on the street just because it suited the bottom line of their employers.
So what is your response then to this kind of fear-mongering that we're hearing as well when the topic of just transition comes up?
Yeah, well, the oil industry wants people to think that it's essential to Canada's economic future. And in this regard, it's important to get the facts straight. So in our report, we did an inventory of all the different jobs in the direct fossil fuel sector. So this includes extraction and production. It includes refining. It includes pipelines and transportation, distribution systems, coal mining, as well as oil and gas. And lo and behold, it's about 175,000 jobs in Canada that are directly involved in all of those tasks, which is just under 1% of the total workforce. So, you know, 175,000 jobs is a lot of jobs. I'm not downplaying it. And if you have one of those jobs, it's a really important job. But it's under 1% of the workforce. And if you're looking at phasing out fossil fuels over the next quarter century, or at least most uses of fossil fuels in a net zero arrangement, shifting 1% of employment from one industry to all the other industries that are out there is hardly going to be visible in the statistics. That's how small and gradual it is. And this is contrary to the myths that are propagated by the well-financed, you know, advertising and lobbying campaigns that the oil industry takes on. Fossil fuel production is an important industry in Canada, but it's not what our bread and butter depend on. And the greatest irony, too, for those who are trying to play the affordability card, the fossil fuel sector has been the biggest single problem of affordability concerns over the last 5 years, particularly from the big run-up in oil prices that happened in 2022. That was the biggest single cause of all the inflation that we've been trying to grapple with since. So it's not, the industry is not the lifeblood of our economy, not remotely. And challenging that propaganda with actual facts and figures about where the jobs are and where they aren't, again, is not to diminish the importance of these jobs to the workers and their families and their communities that depend on it. But it is to say this is a manageable challenge. And if we do it right, it's going to be much better for those fossil fuel workers than waiting till they get thrown out on the street by their boss because, lo and behold, their job has been replaced by a self-driving truck or an AI algorithm. Because that's what's going to happen otherwise, and it is happening.
You raised something that I think comes up in the report as well, which is that if done right, there's actually a lot of benefit that could come from this just transition. The report goes into a bit about job creation and investment. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Well, obviously, we are going to phase out the use of fossil fuels for various reasons, environmental reasons, obviously, but also economic reasons, because the new advances in renewable energy systems and energy conservation are cheaper and more efficient, as well as being less polluting. So this is going to happen, regardless of, you know, the to and fro of climate policy and the politicized debates that go on around it. This is absolutely going to happen. So there's a natural, I think, tendency to sort of connect those two dots to say, okay, fossil fuel use is going to disappear gradually for the most part. You know, we may have a few uses of fossil fuels still even in the net zero setting that are offset by other carbon capture strategies, but or carbon reducing strategies, but most fossil fuel use is going to disappear. And at the same time, we're going to grow these big projects and investments in renewable energy creation and generation transmission, and then all of the industries and technologies that use renewable energy, you know, from electric vehicles to heat pumps at home to everything else. So, yes, there will be hundreds of thousands of jobs created through the other side of the energy transition. In fact, there'll be more jobs created in that side of it than will be lost on the fossil fuel side, for the reason being that there's more labor required in most of those renewable energy systems and other related developments. Fossil fuel production, among other drawbacks, hardly creates any jobs. Every $1 million of GDP in the oil industry, for example, the upstream oil industry, produces one half of a job for $1 million GDP because it's so capital intensive and there's so little labor that's required. Compare that to the economy as a whole, where every $1 million of GDP creates about 6 jobs. So shifting from fossil fuels to just about anything else is a net job creator. And that will include all of those renewable energy systems and investments. So yes, think about those jobs. But a key point of our report is it's in a way more it's, in a way, it's easier than just saying we have to take someone from a fossil fuel position and put them to work, you know, building windmills or constructing an electricity transmission line or installing solar panels, because there's another 98% of the economy. You know, if there's 1% of jobs in fossil fuels, as we showed, and then a little bit more than 1% of jobs in renewable energy systems, because they are going to create more jobs than exist in fossil fuels, which is great. But you've still got 98% of the rest of the economy where people could go and work and other industries that are growing, including industries that are adjacent to or very similar in skill requirements to fossil fuel production, including non-fossil mining and resource activities, transportation, construction. Of course, a lot of fossil fuel workers could move easily into construction, manufacturing, professional and technical services. These are all industries that can offer good jobs, you know, as long as there's unions and good collective bargaining agreements and good labor standards, there'll be good jobs. And there'll be even more opportunities in those sectors than there will be in the renewable energy field. So, you know, I'm a big believer in the great opportunities in renewable energy if we get with the program and make these investments in clean energy. But the transition process can be even bigger and more flexible and easier in the end if we give people the full portfolio of choices. If you're a fossil fuel worker and you're not going to be young and old enough to retire when your part of the industry phases out, well, guess what? There's a million other areas out there. And if you had the proper support, including income support, training, relocation opportunities, etc., this will be doable. And there's lots of experience internationally, even in Canada, with how transitions like this, when they are supported, can be done without any unfair dislocation or hardship for groups of people.
It sounds like a really nice possibility. So I'm curious, you know, in the current climate, you know, there's the issues with trade with the U.S. that are causing job losses. There's cuts to the federal public service, all these things that are leading to the cuts of jobs. How can we ensure that there are jobs available, I guess, when people transition out of the fossil fuel industry?
Well, we have seen, interestingly, how the oil industry has really seized on the threats posed by Donald Trump to double down on their lobbying and propaganda campaigns that, well, yes, the only way for Canada to survive against Donald Trump is to build more pipelines and export more oil and LNG. So it's always an eye-opener for me that no matter what happens in the world, in their eyes, it's a good excuse to produce more fossil fuels. And Donald Trump is the latest excuse in that regard. And they've had success trying to change Canadians' ideas about fossil fuel projects because we're worried and we're concerned and we're really pissed off about Donald Trump and what he's trying to do to Canada. So we've got a challenge ahead of us to confront that sort of bandwagon around fossil fuel export projects as being the magic bullet that will save us. You know, of course, there will be jobs involved if they build a pipeline, but there's jobs involved if we build just about anything, including affordable housing, public transit, electric transmission lines to connect our provinces. You know, here we are, a country that's 160 some years old, and we still haven't got a east-west electricity grid that's adequate for the country. Hundreds of thousands of jobs involved in building those things. So, you know, it's going to be a battle. And, you know, through the work that we've done at the Center for Future Work, for example, we hosted a thing called the Elbows Up Economic Summit last fall, where we brought together progressive economists and other policy experts to talk about what would a truly sovereign and sustainable and inclusive economy look like if we were going to build one in Canada that could withstand Trump. And, you know, continuing to rely on exports of oil and gas, even if we sell oil and gas to China instead of to America, isn't going to be our savior. We need much more than that, including investing in a diversified economy through industrial strategies that add value to our resources rather than just digging them out of the ground and selling them overseas. Big investments in domestic infrastructure. Public services. Public services are part of a strong economy. And in fact, they're relatively insulated from trade attacks from Donald Trump and elsewhere because the public sector and the services like education and healthcare that it provides are here in Canada. They can't be touched by Trump's tariffs. So we should be investing more in those things, not less. So I think, you know, all the progressive forces, the environmental movement, the labor movement, the Canadian sovereignty movement, I think need to link arms at this moment and put forward a different vision of how we respond to Trump's attacks and debunk the simplistic idea that, well, what we got to do is double down on what we've always done in Canada, dig stuff out of the ground and sell it to other countries. That's not going to do it for us.
And how do you feel about how things are going right now in terms of whether Canada is moving towards, you know, making those investments in a diversified economy and all of that?
Oh, it's very complicated and very conflicted right now. You know, of course, we've seen Mark Carney become leader of the Liberal Party and then win the election against the odds, against Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives. And now we've seen Poilievre and the Conservatives shooting themselves in the foot, you know, again, with their outrageous ideology. Their latest focus on attacking immigrants is shameful and dangerous. And yet he's sinking further and further in the polls. So that's a good thing to see the populist right losing in Canada. On the other hand, the Liberals have taken on an awful lot of what Poilievre was arguing before and are clearly being influenced by big business in Canada, including the fossil fuel industry. So we've seen them jump on board the LNG bandwagon and possibly the oil pipeline bandwagon. I don't know what will happen there because it's both the economics and the politics of a pipeline are very complicated. At the same time, you know, to be fair, we've seen the federal government, including in its recent budget, put some significant money into better things, including, you know, a national housing strategy that's in the right direction, but not strong enough. Other public infrastructure projects. And in the major projects category that Mr. Carney's been emphasizing, there are some good projects in there, including, you know, big investments in wind energy, for example, or using critical minerals and processing them and manufacturing them in Canada as part of the energy transition rather than just digging them out and selling them abroad. So, you know, it's very complicated, and Mr. Carney is clearly trying to appeal to all sides here in his effort. But I do think those progressive movements I mentioned, the environmental movement, the labor movement, the Canadian sovereignty movement, the other equality-seeking movements are going to have to be strong and loud and united in pushing the government to do better on all of those fronts.
And so what do you think, you know, the next few years ahead would kind of look like in terms of what should be coming from the progressive movements, how we should be organizing and uniting and things like that?
Well, if I had a crystal ball to see what was happening in the next few years, Gabby, I could be rich. I would short the markets in the right places, make billions of dollars, and of course, give it all to political progressive causes. I can't predict what's going to happen tomorrow, especially with Donald Trump in charge. He could pick up the phone in some, you know, rant this evening and declare World War III, let alone, you know, another wild gyration in the tariffs. So this is a, you know, a very unstable and in many ways frightening time. And this, again, is where Canada almost has to be on a kind of a wartime footing. Some of the folks at our Elbows Up Summit in September phrased it this way. All the papers, by the way, Gabby, from our Elbows Up Summit are posted through the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives. But how we navigate this period ahead is going to be tricky. And I'll tell you that I'm confused and frustrated that we haven't been able to pull together a sort of united movement. I'm a veteran of the original fights against the free trade agreement in the 1980s. I've just dated myself there. But we were able at that point to pull together a huge coalition. At the time, it was called the Pro-Canada Network, and then it evolved into other incarnations. But where we brought the labor and feminist and community and anti-poverty and environmental movements together to say, look, doing a free trade deal where we put all of our eggs in the basket of a relationship with the United States puts us in a very vulnerable position. And man, were we right. It doesn't give me any pleasure to say I told you so, but we were right. And the idea that because of this dependence on the U.S. market, we'd be vulnerable to extortion has really proven true. And I think we need something like that movement again. You know, obviously it's different. The politics are different. The technology and communication strategies and activism strategies are different. But I do think we need to come together in a common cause that says the future of Canada is at stake, not just the future sovereignty of Canada, but the future essence of Canada. It's, you know, we can remain sovereign, but give up the values that make us proud to be Canadian. That would still be a defeat. And I'd love to see a Pro-Canada Network 2.0 that comes together around the challenges faced by Trump and that pushes the Carney government and other provincial governments in Canada to do better.
That was Rabble Labour reporter Gabriella Kaluge-Kasuga and economist Jim Stanford. Thanks so much for that, Gabby and Jim. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to speed is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Take it away, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with national news. Prime Minister Mark Carney and his government have sent mixed signals in response to the U.S. and Israeli war against Iran. Carney initially stated his support for the attack on the Iranian regime, while later calling U.S. actions inconsistent with international law. Carney changed tack again later in the week by not ruling out the possibility of Canadian participation in the actions against Iran. By comparison, NDP interim leader Don Davies condemned U.S. and Israeli strikes against Iran, which has included the devastating bombing of an all-girls elementary school that killed nearly 200 people. In a statement on social media, Davies said, quote, "There is no question, none, that the U.S.-Israeli military attack on Iran is illegal and violates all international law. But the indiscriminate bombing of civilian-dense cities is a war crime, plain and simple." End quote. Also this week, the Alberta Federation of Labour is calling for a federal windfall profits tax on oil companies in response to the war against Iran. Iran is one of the world's largest oil-producing countries and has already closed the Strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf to all shipping, which usually sees 20 million barrels of oil pass through it a day. Rising oil prices, therefore, are a direct result of the U.S. and Israeli attack on Iran. This is not the only time in recent history where an armed conflict has led to rising oil prices. After Russia illegally invaded Ukraine in 2022, oil prices jumped by 65%, and that price increase led to crippling inflation at the time. While Canadians struggled to make ends meet, oil companies saw record profits. According to the Alberta Federation of Labour, most of those profits were sent overseas. And finally, in labour news, an Ontario-based company that runs a handful of long-term care facilities is reversing its plan to cut employee hours at one of its residences. Sienna Senior Living is backtracking on an announced plan to reduce employee hours at Case Manor in Bobcaige in Ontario by nearly 1,300 hours across 75 full-time employees. This decision has been made unilaterally without consulting the Canadian Union of Public Employees, which represents workers at the facility. In response, the union held rallies outside of Case Manor and outside of Sienna Senior Living's headquarters in Markham, Ontario. After weeks of public pressure, Sienna announced that they were reversing their decision and even considering increasing hours of their employees. And as always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick, and that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Finally, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.